Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. As members of the monastic community, as summoners, it's good to reflect upon what the samana dhamma is. What is defining qualities of a samana, one who has gone forth into monastic training. Literally, the word samana means one who has become calm, a calmed one who has settled their being. This is a good, beautiful principle to reflect upon. And the principle also of a samana is one who has gone forth from the household life, and anagarika, one who has left the gara, the house, and is homeless. This is the basic standard that we undertake as a samana, is that of homelessness. We have a conscious intention to leave behind the usual worldly standards of owning property, using money, acquiring the familiar attributes of stability, material security, trying to guarantee a life that is comfortable, that is predictable and secure through the acquisition of worldly property and power and finances and so on and so forth. So a samana, when one goes forth, there's a deliberate and conscious disempowerment. There's a stepping down from the effort to control. So there's a deliberate relinquishment of control, so that we, as a samana, we let go of the use of money. We don't have any money to have power over. We can't control the world through buying things, purchasing things that we like, things that we wish for. We relinquish power over food. The nuns and monks, ones who have gone forth, they can't control what food we eat each day. Just whatever food is offered, that's what we eat. That's what's available to us. We relinquish power even over the maintenance of our own physical being. Learning to live upon what is freely offered, what comes forth from the universe and from the kind hearts of those who gather around us and who wish to support this way of life and this pattern of being. So there's a deliberate relinquishment of worldly power, worldly security, and the ownership of personal property. So we don't own our own houses or our own resources. There's a setting aside of that as a conscious and specific attitude, that is a mode of relating to the world that is deliberately established, that we are consciously laying aside those worldly forms of security. And the Buddha very deliberately set up this way of life. He adopted it himself. He was a samana, a homeless one, a wanderer. And he espoused this way of life, and this is the way of training that's been established and used ever since the Buddha's time. And it's good to consider, what is this about? Why do we live this way? And what's the purpose behind that relinquishment of that kind of power? And where do we get our support? Where does our sense of security come from? Because in that very gesture of going forth, of pabbaja, letting go of those, worldly controls, worldly resources, at that very same moment, and going forth, letting go of the power over money and control over food and so forth, at the same time, we take refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. The three refuges are adopted instead of the worldly refuges of money and power and property and status. We instead we consciously let those go to instead make room for Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, the properties of wisdom, of realism, and of virtue, unselfishness. These become the resources that we look to instead. That's a conscious change of direction, or a conscious, exchange of values that taking on the life of a monastic involves. It's good to also consider one of the definitions of a samana that I found from Lumpo Cha that I found had a big impact on me when I read it. I think it was in Paul Breiter's book, Venerable Father, where Lumpo Cha is quoted as saying, "A samana is one who has no future." A samana is one who has no future. So from a worldly perspective, according to worldly patterns of thinking, having no future is a disaster. That's, oh dear, that's terrible. I'm ruined, I have no future. So, but for a samana, it's the opposite. I have no future, great, I'm heading in the right direction. This is the desirable mode. And when he said a samana is one who has no future, it's a deliberate setting aside of those worldly resources, those worldly refuges of wanting to have guaranteed as much as is possible what's going to happen tomorrow, that I will be able to provide for myself tomorrow. I know that I'll have something to eat tomorrow. I'll have a place to go tomorrow. I'll have things to support me tomorrow and into the future. Defining a samana as one who has no future is a conscious letting go of that, supporting the attitudes of self-view, and instead it's encouraging a realism and an attunement to the here and now reality, and also a sense of trust, a sense of faith that you're not trying to create a future, you're not trying to plan things out, you're not trying to hold an idea in place with a rigid and fixed view, but there's rather an openness and an attunement to the Pachupana Dhamma, the here and now Dhamma, and trusting that with mindfulness being established in the here and now, then we'll be able to adapt to whatever life brings, in the next minute, the next hour, the next day, the next year. We don't need to be thinking in terms of what the future will bring. Also, just to when considering that for myself, that I remember when reading that phrase, that a samana is one who has no future, there's a sense of shock, like, because the mind does tend to think in terms of where I'm going, how long I plan to be here, having come to this place, how things are going, is what I'd like to do or to bring into being while I'm here, what I'd like to achieve while I'm here, the projects I've got on, the things I'd like to learn, the things I'd like to do. We conceive ourselves. We conceive the person that we feel we are very much in terms of a span of time. We measure ourselves, even as samanas, as monastics, in terms of the years that we have been ordained. You know, I am 30, this is my 33rd rains retreat as a bhikkhu, so 32 complete, 33 nearly completed. We create ourselves, we perceive ourselves according to spans of time. I've been at Amravati just over a year. Yeah, I am 55 years old. We come up with these numbers and we use them to define who and what we are. And you know, we think also, how much longer do you plan to be here? Well, I'm going to be here for another month, or I'm going to be here for through the winter retreat, or I have no fixed plan for when I'm going to leave. Ooh, I'm here indefinitely. So just that simple phrase, a samana is one who has no future, it holds up a mirror to all that self-creation of how long are we going to be here? Where are we on the timeline? Where are we on the map? And that it holds up a mirror to that. It challenges that and says, oh really? That's who you are? That 33 vasa, or 55 years old, or been here for a year, or yeah, 13 minutes into the Dhamma talk? A samana is one who has no future. It challenges that self-creating habit. That is the in a way the essence of worldly thinking, the way that we establish who and what we are in terms of self-view. I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm a monk, I'm a nun, I'm a layperson, I am this nationality, I'm English, or I'm American, I'm Sri Lankan, I'm Thai, I'm French, I'm Portuguese, Swiss, Indian, or a mixture of the above. It challenges that, and it holds up a mirror to say, oh, really? Is that who and what you are? This number, 55 years old, 33 vasa, been here for a year? Is that it? Really? Oh. And what that does, when we hold up that mirror, that reflection, then it in that moment, it causes that self-creating habit to stumble, to hesitate, to pause, and it touches into that intuitive wisdom that does recognize, oh yes, really? Is that so? I don't think so. I don't think that's the whole story. So the attribute of homelessness, or also the Buddha talked about this in terms of simplicity of living. One of the basic principles of a life of a samana is to try and live as simply as possible. This is why we practice celibacy. We have all these rules about restraining our relationships with other human beings to be of a non-sexual nature, that we relate to each other as sisters and brothers, as fellow human beings, brothers and sisters in old age, sickness and death. That this keeps life very much less complicated than when we're bonding with each other as partners, or forming emotionally intense relationships, emotionally dependent relationships, or having children and then becoming responsible as parents. Just that simple, fundamental principle of celibacy goes a huge way to making life much, much less complicated, much clearer, much simpler. We might think, well, living in Amravati with 30 or 40, 50 other residents You might feel this is pretty complicated, but let me tell you, my experience of being around people who live in Buddhist communities where they don't practice celibacy, this is really, really simple. Life at Amaravati is extremely simple in that regard. So absence of those kind of relationships, absence of the simplicity of personal possessions, the simplicity of clothing for the monastics. I don't have to wake up in the morning and think, what shall I wear today? How shall I do my hair? You know, I think I need a new hairdo. It doesn't work that way. It's just remarkably simple and unencumbered, unburdened. So that the structure of our lives is trying to keep as clear and plain a screen as possible against which the projections of karmic formations can be displayed. So with the backdrop, with the screen of our life as uncomplicated as possible, then the projections of our conditioning, our likes, our dislikes, the karmic resonances of a lifetime can be seen, can be known, can be understood. So this is the principle of simplicity of living. When it's complicated, when our lives are very busy with emotional dependencies, with a multiplicity of choices and activities, and the karmically loaded emotional states being brought into being on a daily basis, hourly basis, then it creates a very colourful and mobile screen upon which the projection of our conditioning is displayed. It's like trying to watch a film against a screen that's multicoloured and with a mobile pattern. It's hard to see what the film is. It's hard to see what the characters are doing because the background is so complicated and active, mobile, confusing. So the monastic life, all the precepts that we keep, and the simplicity of living, the fewness of possessions, the encouragement to live according to standards of honesty, of respectfulness, of gentleness. These are to do with just keeping a clear, simple screen against which those habits of conditioning, of being a woman, being a man, our likes and dislikes, our personal histories, our character traits of extroversion, introversion, and different patterns of conditioning, they are played, they're displayed against that screen, just like a film being projected onto a movie screen. And so then we can see clearly what the projections are. We can see clearly, oh, this is the projection of being, this comes from being English, or being a man, being a ordained for so many years, or being in a particular role as a member of the community, particular jobs that we do in the office or the kitchen or in the teaching seat, wherever it might be. We can see those patterns displayed against the screen, and we can understand what they are. We can see them clearly. We can see them without confusion. It's also good to consider that when we go forth, along with abandoning the worldly values of control over money, control over property, it's also an abandonment of status, that you're letting go of social position, and so that you're stepping down from that of worldly value system of ranking each other, who's an important person, who's an unimportant person, who's a rich person, who's from a good family, a bad family, who's a powerful person, a not powerful person. All these many and various ways that people rank each other in society, when we go forth, we lay that all aside. In this, the Buddha established right from the very beginning that going forth as a samana, as a monastic, you're laying aside the conditioning of caste, you are laying aside the conditioning of social status, whether you're a Brahmin or a Kshatriya, a warrior noble, or whether you're a Sudra or an untouchable, doesn't matter. Whether you're educated or uneducated, doesn't matter. All those aspects of social status are laid aside. So it's important to bear this in mind, particularly in relationship to the forms that we use. There is a hierarchy. We have in the different order that we go through the door in terms of the age of years of ordination. But to take refuge in status, to say get inflated because, you know, I'm not a Navaka monk anymore. I'm a Majjhima. I'm a middle-aged monk now. I've been a monk for 5 years, so you know I'm senior to you. You're just a Navaka. You're just a novice. You're only an Anagarika. Pah. Yeah. The way that we can grasp even the status of a monastic life is ridiculous and very ugly worthy of criticism. This is a wrong grasping of monastic life. The whole gesture of the going forth is a letting go of status, a letting go of those inflated aspects of the human world. It's a stepping down from that. It's giving ourselves a relief from that, being able to relinquish that way of looking at each other and to instead establish a basis of respect and kind of openness, seeing each other as sisters and brothers in old age, sickness and death. That's the basic relationship. The world is how the world is seen through the eyes of a samana. That this is how we can relate to each other. The quality of homelessness then is, in a sense, it's very closely related to selflessness. That on the social level, we establish the value of homelessness, simplicity of needs, simplicity of possessions, so that we are encouraging internally the quality of selflessness, letting go of self-concern, self-view. And just as the Buddha said, talking about the monastic spirit, that like swans that abandon the lake, they leave home after home behind. That as a samana, we should always be ready to relinquish the place where we live, the things that we feel we own, to leave them behind. And as also using the symbol of a bird again, he said, like a bird in flight takes all that it owns wherever it goes. Then similarly, a samana goes unburdened, simply with a bowl and a robe. This is how we are encouraged to travel, encouraged to be. We leave home after home behind, and the few things that we need to get by in the world, the robes and the bowl, those we take with us, and we take care of them with a scrupulous and attentive attitude. But those are the few things, like the bird takes its feathers and its sense of direction. And that's all it needs. So that these qualities of homelessness, letting go of the home externally and being ready to leave home after home behind, this is echoing, or this is supporting the internal work of realizing selflessness, of letting go of self-concern, letting go of all those aspects of possessiveness that go on within us. And this, you know, the last day or two I've been talking a lot about anatta. We also again chanted the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta this evening, and this is all about developing the insight into not-self. So these external aspects of the samana life, the homeless life, the shaved head, the robe, the standards of non-violence, the standards of honesty, the standards of fewness of needs, these are all there to directly support the development of insight into not-self, that we don't own these things. These are not who and what we are. Ne tang mama ne so hamasmi ne so me ata. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. So I like to reflect in this way, that the when we look at the forms of renunciate life, of a monastic training, this is what it's all designed to do, is to support the cultivation of the insight into not-self. It's helping that to be seen clearly. So even though the monastic form is a very definite and clear set of protocols, a set of structures and forms, it's a set of conventions, but its purpose is to help us to see through all conventions. That's it. It's, in a way, it's a form to help the heart to awaken to the empty nature of all forms. So it's a mysterious process in that way. It's like using words to describe the nature of language. It's like a form that helps you to see beyond forms, a convention that helps the heart to awaken to that which is beyond conventions. So setting in place the structures of homelessness is, in a way, trying to establish the ideal conditions for arousing the insight, catalyzing the insight into selflessness, into the realization that all dhammas, all aspects of nature, are not self. They're not who and what we are. They have no owner. And amongst the many things that obstruct that insight, I think yesterday evening I was talking about these same three qualities, what are called the papancha dhammas, these phrases that the Buddha uses over and over again in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, ne tang mama, this is not mine, ne so hamasmi, I am not, ne so me ata, this is not myself. So those three are the papancha dhammas, these different ways that we create the idea, the feeling of self, and that through a misguided belief in the stories that our mind tells, the thoughts that go through our consciousness. That through believing those thoughts, we constantly recreate the sense of self. They are, papancha means conceptual proliferation, and those three aspects of view continually feed that self-creating habit, the tanha, ditti, and mana, craving, conceit, and views. They're in a way the engine of the self-delusion. They are the fuel, the process whereby the habits of self-creation, the habits of self-view, are brought into being and maintained. That's the kind of production center of self-view. Is craving, conceit and views, tanha, ditti and mana. This is how we keep recreating that through all the 10,000 ways during the course of a day that the mind generates these thoughts. I'm this is mine, this is who and what I am, over and over and over and over again. And I find it's useful to bring attention to this, to really bring that to mind, because we keep missing it. We keep believing in this stuff. We keep believing, this is mine, I am this, this is what myself is. So a lot of the practice then revolves around understanding thought, seeing how the thought process works, and learning to not believe in the patterns of thinking that arise and pass in consciousness. And in a way, it's somewhat absurd. It's kind of ridiculous that we go through life with this idea that if I think it, it must be true. Just because a thought passes through our minds, we take it to be an accurate rendition of reality. We take it to be a fully reliable representation of the way that life actually is. Every thought that goes through our minds, we habitually believe that whatever the statement that the thought makes, it's true. And it's ridiculous in many ways, but that's our conditioning, that's the habit, that we take it for granted, that if I think it, it's true. I say that's good, and we believe that's true. We say that's bad, and we believe it's true. We call something a success, we believe it's true. We call it a failure, we believe it's true. And we take those patterns of thinking, those habits of perception and judgment, as absolute realities over and over and over again. So a lot of the practice and the development of insight and the genuine freeing of the heart is establishing a mistrust of the thinking mind. As a Lumpur Sumedho once famously put it, all your thoughts are garbage. Another useful principle to bear in mind, all your thoughts are garbage. If we shift the balance, rather than believing everything that we think as being an absolute fact, we take the other view of it that Lumpur suggested that time, to consider all our thoughts are garbage. It's just a thought. It can only be a half-truth. It can only be a convenient fiction. It can't be an absolutely accurate rendition of the way the universe is. It can't. It's just a thought, like a word. It's just a sound formed in a particular way that in a certain language, a set of agreements that we call the English language, it has a meaning. It can convey a sense, but it's not an absolutely real thing. It's just a noise. These words I'm saying, they're just noises. And for 60% of the people here, English is not your first language. So you're having, some of you are extremely fluent in English, some not so fluent, but there's a certain translation that has to go on, hearing the sound and then deriving a meaning from it. But there's no intrinsic meaning in the sound. If we were here 1,000 years ago and there was a same number of people sitting listening to these noises that are coming out of my mouth, we'd all be thinking, what? Huh? What language is that? Or the Anglo-Saxon, or the Norman French equivalent of that, if this was the year. Instead of being 2011, it was 1011. Actually before the Norman conquest. So I wouldn't be thinking in Norman French, it would be Anglo-Saxon, Celtic. What I'm saying would be complete nonsense, it would have no meaning whatsoever. So our thoughts are the same. They are convenient fictions. And they can only be a rough representation of the way things are, a kind of a good enough description, a sketch, a sort of thumbnail sketch of the way things are. They can point to it, but they can't represent the reality in any kind of absolute and real way. So it's important to use the meditation to make the effort to not believe our thoughts, to develop a clear objectivity to the thinking realm. And this is in order to be able to free the heart from being dominated by the habits of thought. And so for many of us, our minds think so much and are so filled with incessant thinking, it's very hard to believe that it's at all possible to get any kind of objectivity to the thinking process, because it just goes on and on and on. It's one thought chasing after another, after another, after another, with hardly any breaks in between. But it can be done. I fully confess that when I first came in the monastery, I just couldn't believe that my mind could ever stop thinking. It was just absolutely non-stop, seamlessly burbling away, endlessly chattering, commentating and recollecting and planning, and And any time there was anything remotely like a pause, there was always an old pop song would wedge its way in and fill up the gaps. But with patience and application and effort, then we can develop a clear objectivity to the thinking realm. And one exercise that Lumpur Sumedho would often encourage that I find very helpful is to use the meditation to learn how to be objective towards thought by taking some kind of extremely bland and emotionally uncharged statement, like a simple phrase like, "Today is Friday." And when you're sitting in meditation in particular, just to bring the mind to as much quietude as possible and to fix the attention on that still quiet space, and then to deliberately think the word is Friday, or the floor is stone. There's some extremely bland, very simple, philosophically and emotionally unloaded comment. Just to notice the space before, then to watch, to know the string of words, and then to notice the space after, to see, oh, this phrase comes out of the space of the mind, it takes its form, it does its thing, and then it ends. It's a beginning, a middle, and an end. It comes out of nothing, it takes shape, it's present, it ends, it dissolves back into nothing. There's a space before, a space after, and then while that statement is being voiced internally, then it can be known. And so the very fact that you're deliberately bringing it into being, you're creating the maximum supportive conditions for objectivity. You've deliberately invited that thought in. And it's not a compelling thought, like the floor is stone, or today is Friday, or some bland comment. It's not going to draw the attention in, to be able to take some kind of simple verbal structure and state that. Just to be able to see how a conceptual thought, how vitakka works, just seeing a conceptual thought forming in the space of the mind, taking shape and then dissolving. And to use that kind of simple observation, like a little training exercise, like as if you were learning to play the piano, and you take a little three-note phrase, dun 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 dun, just playing it over and over and over, so that your thumb and your fingers learn which notes to go to make that very, very simple, brief phrase of music, so that you're learning how it works. So this might seem very simplistic or a bit of a waste of time, but I found this an extremely helpful practice. Just being ready to do this, just to be able to see how, look, it works, that you can attend to a thought. There can be mindfulness of a thought coming into being, doing its thing, and then ending. Because mostly we relate to thought as of compelling comments and stories and judgments and ideas and memories and plans, and we get lost completely in their content. It's very, very hard for most of us to step out of a thought and just watch the process of thinking and to know it as simply anicca, dukkha, anatta, because the attention is drawn into the content. The stories are so interesting, so compelling, so charged for us in various ways. So it's very hard to establish that kind of objectivity. But by, in a way, teaching us how to do that, by taking something that is, on the one hand, has been invited in, so you're sort of expecting it to arrive, and then also that it's not something that's particularly interesting, or it's not something that has any sort of weight or karmic or emotional strength to it, then by simply running that kind of phrase through and learning to watch it, to recognize, oh look, there can be mindfulness of a thought forming and when it's present and when it's gone. Then as we learn that skill and develop that simple capacity to watch and to know a thought as it comes and goes, then we find that more and more easily we can do that with the random thoughts that just hatch themselves on their own, that the stray patterns of thinking that arise under their own, say that the force of their own causality, that they're brought into being by hearing a sound or feeling a sensation or a spontaneous memory or an idea. We're far more able to know that thought, to be able to listen to it, to know it, and to not get caught up in its content, to not get drawn into the story that the thought is telling, whether it's a judgment that I like or a judgment I dislike, or that's right and that's wrong. Whatever it might be, we find it's far easier just to be able to listen, to know that thought, just as we can hear the sound of the wind or the sound of a pneumatic drill. We can hear the sound of people, you know, walking on the pathway. It's just a sound. It's just a pattern of mind consciousness. It's just a pattern of, yeah, of sankharas arising, passing away. That's all. So then we're able to know that clearly, to rest in that quality of listening, simply hearing the mind doing its thing. So in this respect, one of the great benefits of using the nada sound, the practice of inner listening, using the sound of silence, the nada sound, as a meditation object, is that it can directly encourage and support this capacity for listening. So using the inner sound, listening to the continuous high-pitched ringing tone that's there in the background of our hearing, the sound of silence, to develop that as a meditation object, just learning to listen to the nada sound, which has no particular meaning, it has no content, it's content that is interesting or compelling. We learn to listen to the nada sound just to rest in that quality of hearing, of knowing that sound, then developing that capacity to listen in a receptive way, then we find that we can listen to our own thoughts with the same kind of unentangled objectivity, unentangled participation in the process of experience, that we can hear a thought arising, a judgment, a feeling, an enthusiasm, a regret, a sadness, a fantasy, a memory, a plan, in exactly the same way as we can listen to the nada sound, just rolling on and on and on, flowing in an unbroken stream, the silvery stream of the sound of silence. In exactly the same way, we can just listen to the flow of thought going through the mind, not making anything of it, not feeling like we have to push it away, make it shut up or resent it for intruding upon our quiet. We can just know it just as the sound of silence. We can know the sound of a thought, the patterns, the shapes of a thought, just like we can know the patterns and textures, the shapes of a sensation in our legs, the feeling of the cloth on our skin, of our clothing, the sounds of the room, of people clearing their throat or shuffling on the cushion. It's just patterns of consciousness taking shape, dissolving. Now there are certain patterns of thinking, though, that do draw the attention in far more dramatically or compellingly than others. And particularly if there's some kind of a doubt that the mind is caught in some kind of question that we are being burdened by, that some sort of decision that we have to make in our life, or some kind of concern about whether we're doing the right thing, or should I do this practice or that practice, or am I in the best place, or should I go somewhere else or do something else, or what should I do in relationship to this particular difficulty in my life, or this conflict with another person. So doubts can take on a particular weight, they can be particularly compelling, it can feel like there's almost, it's a different category of thinking, like, this isn't just a thought, this is a problem. This is a real problem, and I can't possibly rest until I've figured this out. I can't possibly be at peace until this doubt has been resolved. Should I or shouldn't I? What should I do? What's the right thing to do? What's the best thing to do? And so that we can be thoroughly burdened and stressed by the mind being caught in doubt of this kind, and endlessly tied up in a tangle of thinking, trying to get to the end of a doubt by thinking, by weighing up all the pros and cons, all the points for, the points against. But anyone who's spent much time in meditation and dealing with this kind of aspect of the mind will know that you can't think your way to the end of a doubt. Because no matter how much we think, we try and pile up the evidence to support one side of the case. But no matter how thoroughly we try to work it out, it's like an endless courtroom battle that no matter how good a case one lawyer makes for the judgment to go in their particular direction. The lawyer for the defense makes an extremely thorough and what they feel is a watertight case, and the lawyer for the prosecution just comes in and says, "Ah, yes, but on the other hand," and comes in with a whole new raft of evidence and arguments, and it just goes on and on and on like an endless courtroom battle that has no conclusion, and that no matter how much you pile up the evidence and try and force it to get some kind of a judgment, then it just goes to appeal and it goes back to the courts and gets chewed over again and again and again. So I'd suggest that it's impossible to think your way to finality in the issue of doubt. It's not a matter of calculating your way to certainty, to a feeling of resolution. It doesn't seem ever to be possible. But doubts can be resolved, but they're not resolved through more and more thinking, but rather learning to see how doubt works. And again, this is some area of practice that Lumpur Sumedho has been extraordinarily skilled and helpful in explaining over the years. I think particularly because he was a world-class doubter, and similarly Ajahn Chah was one who had the same kind of mental habits. The mind could get caught in endless tangles of thinking and doubting and uncertainty, not sure what's the right, what's wrong, what's good or what's bad. So the trick with doubt is to see how, when a doubt arises, what should I do? That it feels like there's a question there that's missing an answer. And we feel that if I could just get the answer, it would be like having the missing piece that's slotted into that gap, and then there'll be this question, there's this answer, click, the answer locks into the place where there's the gap, just like a piece from a jigsaw puzzle being locked into the gap, and then you have the complete picture. The last piece of the jigsaw, click, goes into the place, and there you have the picture is resolved. And that can be the image that we have in mind, that sense of trying to find that thing that's going to make us feel complete. But what Lumpo Sumedho would always suggest is to recognize that when a doubt arises, to see that it is a complete thing in and of itself. That what the doubt is saying is, I'm incomplete, you know, please, you know, complete me. I need to have the answer, otherwise the universe is not complete. The universe has got a bit missing. But when we take a step back and we recognize that a doubt, it's telling you it's an incomplete thing, but actually it's not. It's a whole and complete thing in and of itself. The doubt arises out of that same space, like in exactly the same way we can take a bland statement like today is Friday. We can take the question that we're wrestling with, what should I do? Where should I go? And in exactly the same way, we can notice the space before and then listen to the statement of the question. Where should I go? What should I do? Am I doing the right thing? And even though there can be a hungering or a raging demand, like, but I've got to know this is a serious problem. I can't just look at this as a mental condition. It's my responsibility to figure it out. I've got to know. It takes a great resolution and a patience, a restraint to not be sort of sucked into that whirlpool of compulsion, but to recognize this is just a mental formation. It's telling me it's incomplete, but actually it comes out of the silence of the mind. It does its thing. What should I do? And then just like any other statement, it comes to an end. It comes out of the silence. It dissolves into the silence. That's all. It arises and passes away. So that then what we're in a sense doing is allowing that question to hover in the space of the mind, to know it as a simply as a condition. And the kind of phrase that Lumpur would use would be just to know that the doubt is a doubt. So it takes a huge amount of restraint and effort to not get drawn in. But if that effort can be made, if that quality of restraint can be established, then what you find is that just allowing that kind of space around the doubt, just knowing it as a sankhara, as a mental formation that arises, does its thing, then in a mysterious way you find you're able to see the whole issue from a far broader perspective. You're able to tap into your own intuitive wisdom, in a way to read the whole situation in a different way. And so when you don't get sucked into the question, to the content of the question, but you just let it arise, to know it and pass away, then in a mysterious way the answer tends to arise on its own, but from a completely different angle, or just takes shape in an unexpected way. And that you're drawing upon your own intuitive wisdom that can resolve the issue, but not in the terms that you've been asking the question, or not in the according to the expectations and conditioning that you've been bringing to it. So when you drop the question, then the answer appears. And the answer can be something like, wrong question. or it can be, you know what you really want. Why are you even asking, dummy? It can take shape in all sorts of different ways, but when that kind of understanding or that intuitive wisdom, that intuition arises, it has a whole different quality. There's a certainty to it, an understanding, and an accuracy, a validity to it that is not just derived from, say, a process of logical thought coming to an answer that makes sense, but in a way it has a fitness. It fits just in a way like you put a shoe on and you know, oh, it fits. You don't have to doubt about it. There's no question about it. There's a natural, say, recognition of the rightness of it, the accuracy of it, the the perfection of it. So it's a mysterious way that this works, but it's by stepping out of the question, leaving the question alone, allowing there to be space around the question, to know it arise, to listen to it, to let it fade, letting that doubt hover in the space of the mind, then just that extra room that's allowed around it, then from that spaciousness, we are drawing upon our more profound quality of wisdom, the natural attunement of the heart to the reality of the way things are, the fabric of the whole world, how it all fits together, and that attunement of the heart to its own nature and the nature of the way things are, then that brings forth, or that is the source of a more complete understanding. It sees the picture more completely. It sees the picture from angles that you didn't realize were possible, and helps us to say let go of presumptions and limitations that we had been unconsciously restricted by, and our perceptions were colored by. I think that's enough words for this evening. So please, once again, whatever is useful, please take it and use it. Whatever is not, then please just leave that aside.
Dhamma